So I was completely hooked because Award, and she has also written the Beyond Belief, the Secret Gospel of today to be doing this panel with Elaine Pagels, who I'm sure all of you know. She is the Harrison Spear Payne Professor of Religion at Princeton, and she has written several books, including Adam and Eve and the Serpent, The Origin of Satan, and the Gnostic Gospels, which won the National Book Critics Award and the National Book Award, and she has also written the Beyond Belief, the Secret Gospel of Thomas. I talked to Elaine briefly a week or so ago before we did this panel, and I told her that one of the reasons I wanted to do the conversation with her is because I'm just starting a book on religion in Washington, and that I had really spent the last year reading and talking to people before I start doing my actual interviews. And that one of the people I had been talking to is a guy named John Meacham, who's the managing editor of Newsweek and who is a religious scholar, does most of the religious covers in Newsweek, and has just written a book on the Founding Fathers in there. And they're called American Gospel and their views about religion. And that when I started last September doing all my reading, I said to Elaine that I've always called myself an atheist. And that after having many lunches with John, who kept saying, "You're not an atheist," and I would say, "Yes, I am." And he finally convinced me that I was not an atheist and I shouldn't call myself an atheist because I shouldn't define myself negatively. And I thought that made a lot of sense to me. And so I said to Elaine, "I've always called myself an atheist, but I don't call myself that anymore, but I don't quite know what to call myself." And she burst out laughing. And so what I'd like to do, I have a whole agenda here, but I'd like to just start out in the very beginning by asking Elaine what she calls herself and how she defines herself as a religious person or as a spiritual person or not.
Well, that's a tough question, yeah. You know, because all of the terms we use are very much loaded. Like you, I was brought up in a family that was nominally Christian and Protestant, but without a great deal of investment in it. They weren't religious. My father had given up the Presbyterianism of his family for Darwin and became a biologist and decided the Bible was full of, you know, silly lies. And basically, religion was for people who were not educated well enough, as of course we were. So this was a rather snobbish view that a lot of people then shared. Also because they were realizing that the stories in the Bible are anything but, just bad science, which is what my father and other people thought they were. So I was absolutely fascinated, much to my parents' horror, by poems, by architecture, by painting, dance, every kind, absolutely every kind. But there's something about those with a religious quality to them that particularly I found compelling, whether they were the Hopi dances that are danced on the mesas, whether it was Notre Dame in Paris, whether it was the kind of poems of John Donne. I love all of his poems, but there are the erotic poems and the divine poems, and there's something about those with some kind of spiritual dimension in them that were particularly compelling. Then I was invited to an evangelical church when I was 13 or 14 and fell right in. I just thought it was great. The passion, the intensity of the way those people sang and, you know, the way they were involved was enormously powerful, I thought. I think now that it was a language of emotion. And emotion was not a language that was spoken very much in my family. So that was an extraordinary experience. And about a year later, I fell out of love. This is, you know, like an adolescent love affair. I fell in love with this evangelical church because it was so powerful and intense and closely knit, and fell out of it with the same reasons, because they now start to tell you who you can associate with and what you can do and all about sexual practices that I thought were bizarre. And, you know, that if your friend is Jewish, he's going to hell, this sort of thing. And I suddenly thought, no, I don't belong here at all. This is not it. So when I went off to college, I decided to try. This is an old Protestant fantasy, that if you can read the Gospels in Greek, you can get to them without any mediator. You can get to them direct. So I started to do that, and I found that they were absolutely compelling and powerful. But I also discovered the world of Greek religion, of Sappho and Homer and Pindar, the great, and I realized that these are also a religious poetry of a very different kind. So I was completely hooked, because now I realize that religion has more to do with imagination and the way our brains put together senses of meaning than it does with particular traditions. So when I went off to graduate school, I decided to study religion. In college, this was at Stanford, there was no such subject. You could study anthropology to zoology, but there was no religion. If you wanted to know about religion, you were sent to the chaplain. I never went to the chaplain. So I didn't want to know that kind of thing. So I went off to graduate school at Harvard to find out about religion, and discovered there were all these secret gospels that I'd never heard of. And that set me onto a quest of discovery, and it was enormously exciting. I didn't expect. So what do I call myself? Well, depends on the context, I'd say. Basically, I'm more of an explorer than a believer. I've gotten a lot less interested in what I believe, because I think a preoccupation with belief, do you believe in God, do you not believe in God, is a particularly Christian thing, which is not really applicable to the West of the world religion, not to Judaism, not to Buddhism, not to Hinduism. Belief is a particular style of Christianity that I'm not now finding very interesting. But the phenomenon of religion captivates me. So I'm a seeker. And I do that in the context of Christianity, because this is like my home religion. I remember once in graduate school, I decided to quit and study Buddhism. But I went to the person who was teaching Buddhism, Professor Nagatomi, and discovered you have to really immerse yourself in Sanskrit and Chinese and Japanese to get a sense of that. And I was already immersed in Greek and Coptic and Latin and Hebrew. And I realized it was a hopeless cause to try to do both. Besides, this is my home, you know? I have many friends who are Buddhists, but as a Westerner, I can love Buddhism. I'm just not in that tradition in the same way. So I could love it in a different way. What do I call myself? Some kind of a seeker in the context of the Christian traditions and their forerunners, Judaism certainly, Greek religion.
You told me on the phone that you have a friend who called himself a practicing Christian but not a believing Christian.
This was Freeman Dyson, the wonderful physicist.
That's right.
Who says he's a practicing Christian but not a believing Christian. I really like that.
Yeah.
Because the values that are articulated in the Gospels, you know, about community, about loving one another, about what matters to God, whatever we mean by that, is how we are with other people. It's not about anything else.
Well, as Karen Armstrong said, it's not what you believe, but how you behave, which I thought was a really wonderful expression.
I think that has a lot to do with it. And yet the belief is about the ways we put meaning together. So I'm not saying belief isn't important. I mean, you know, when you get into your car, you believe it's going to start. But that, hopefully, but that belief is based on experience. And I think there are other kinds of belief, like who do you trust? What friend do you trust? That's based on experience. It can be proven or disproven. It's not the kind of belief that says, just believe what I tell you with no foundation at all. I think that is rather useless.
Do you practice religion? Do you go to church?
I found I was incorrigibly religious, Sally. I mean, if I go, yes, I do go to a church in Princeton, Presbyterian. See, I'm slipping up. I go usually to an Episcopalian church. I also go to yoga a lot now, almost as much as I go to church. I find if I go to a bar mitzvah, I find I'm very moved by that. So I just find I'm enormously susceptible to whatever it is. And partly studying religion became a kind of vaccine against getting caught and captured into one system that had to be right. I mean, I've had a dose of that when I was 13 and 14, and that's a great age to do it when the world is opening up and you want the world to be simpler than it is.
Do you find that religion sustains you?
Well, that's a good question. Sustains, go further with
well,
that.
Well, all right. I don't know whether most of you know here, but Elaine had just a major tragedy, two major tragedies in her life. She lost a child at 6 and a half, and then a year later her husband was killed. And particularly for someone who is has made religion a career, obviously that would make people turn to you and say, well, did that help you? Did your religion help you? Did it sustain you through that difficult period?
Well, it's a good question. I found that never was religion and its comforts further than when my son died and when my husband died. I mean, that struck me as much darkness as I've ever experienced and as I ever hope to. So I found, you know, the beliefs and the comforts of religion enormously distant at that time. But I did discover that religious exploration is a way of healing certain kinds of deep pain. I mean, I think these are ways back to recovery.
Can you just give us an example when you say religious exploration?
Well, actually, in that case, my late husband was a physicist, and we always came here to Aspen for the physics center. And we came from the time we were married, which was quite a long time ago. And he was working on chaos theory when he died. And like all physicists, if you know physicists in this town, as I know some of you do, like Ed, you know that they all like to hike. They love the natural world. They love challenges. He was not particularly religious in any conventional sense, but he did love the mountains. And I had to struggle with despair, I guess. That's right. With a desire to just not feel that much pain. It was overwhelming because we were actually soulmates. So struggling with that, I realized I had an impulse to blame somebody. And I went to a very good psychiatrist who said, this is always the impulse to blame somebody. I mean, he fell off a mountain, Pyramid Peak. It's a very rough mountain, those of you who've climbed it. He'd been down it 7 times. Who do you blame? You know, there was actually nobody. And I realized it would have been much easier to be a Christian in the second century when you could blame not God, but Satan. You know, Satan did things like that. So I wrote a book on the origin of Satan and the perceptions about having an evil principle in the world to blame. But I couldn't write it with any conviction because I don't believe that. it didn't make sense to me. I was more converted to chaos theory than I was to any view of Satan. But writing the book became a way of dealing with the emotional states that come about in extreme grief. And I think that religious imagination and story and conviction are ways that we deal with questions about meaning. You know, how does one go on after that? We'd adopted two small children after our babies, two babies after our son died. And that seemed to me like a thread of meaning. So I realized what I was doing was inventing a story for myself that connected my late husband, the child that we lost, these two children we adopted. And I was finding ways of finding meaning. And that's where I came to that wonderful book of Viktor Frankl's, which many of you may know, Man's Search for Meaning. He talks about how, well, he quoted Nietzsche. He said, people can live with almost any how if they have a why. Now, I didn't exactly have a why, but I was looking for a sense of meaning. And there were ways of exploring that through the work and through the study of religion, which I think is all about meaning.
Well, that I'm glad you mentioned Viktor Frankl because I wanted to bring that up. But first, in the Gospels, there were two things. What you and I had talked about on the phone was one of the things that I've gotten very interested in the last year is the relationship between religion and psychotherapy, or religion and psychiatry. And the Gnostic Gospels, and I'll let Elaine tell you a little bit about the Gnostic Gospels, but these are some Gospels that were found in 1945 in Egypt by this Egyptian farmer, and it turns out that they were sort of the lost Gospels. And the Gnostics were, which means knowing, were people who sort of broke away, I hope I'm getting this right,
from the
mainstream Christians. And they really annoyed the institutional church because, well, what was then the nascent institutional church, because they basically were on their own. They didn't feel that they needed a sort of organized, established church. But there were two things that I read that were in the Gnostic Gospels, two quotes that I thought were interesting, which brings us to the whole question of the complementary nature of religion and psychotherapy. One of them from the Gospel of Thomas, where he says, if you bring forth what is within you, what you bring forth will save you. If you do not bring forth what is within you, what you do not bring forth will destroy you. And then in the Gnostic Gospels, Jesus says to Thomas, for whoever has not known himself has known nothing, but whoever has known himself has simultaneously achieved knowledge about the depth of all things. And it seems to me that so much of what the Gnostics were talking about was knowing yourself. And when we talk about, is religion relevant in our lives today, and the whole idea of religion and psychotherapy, you wonder if what the Gnostics were talking about was to know yourself, then to find a relationship with God or goodness or peace or happiness, could you not just go to a psychiatrist or go to a therapist? And you talked about going to a therapist after you had this tragedy in your life. Did that give you any kind of sustenance? How would you sort of compare this search for meaning through any kind of religion and through psychiatry or psychotherapy?
Well, those are two enormous issues, and let me try to separate them. First, about the Gnostic Gospels.
And you only have 5 minutes.
Thank you. First, about the Gnostic Gospels. These are texts that, when I went to graduate school to study the beginning of Christianity, I had the fantasy that drives most people to do that, which is that if you go back to the beginning of the Christian movement, you could sort of listen in on Jesus and the disciples as they're on the hills of Galilee, and you could get the real story, you know, pure, simple truth, and not filtered through 2,000 years of innumerable voices reinterpreting it. But then I discovered that my professors had these huge file cabinets full of Gospels I'd never heard of. The Gospel of Thomas, the Gospel of Mary Magdalene, the Gospel of Peter, the Gospel of Truth. And some of them are marvelous. And what you said just now, Sally, was an absolutely accurate read of what I learned in graduate school and what I wrote in the Gnostic Gospels, that these people were sort of anti-institutionalist mavericks who went out on their own. And now we've learned that's not true. We've recently learned that these are monastic literature. These are Christians who started out with the whole Christian community. They were baptized, but they wanted to go further. They wanted to develop spiritually. And their literature is preserved largely by monks who were people who had devoted themselves to the spiritual life and wanted to develop techniques of the spiritual life, which, you know, we find in Buddhism, but we don't often find in early Christianity. So instead of being a sort of aberrant, strange, weird, oddball form of Christianity, which is what I was told, my dear professor, Christer Stendahl, used to say, we just thought these texts were weird. You know, and that's what we were told. They were weird. Now we realize that they're actually the advanced course. That is the way that Jewish tradition has, Orthodox Jewish tradition, you follow Torah, and then later you could advance to Kabbalah, which is mystical interpretation. These other Gospels are secret traditions which really claim to be deeper understandings, not contradictions, but deeper understandings, which actually go into a lot of psychological and spiritual depth. So that's one way that this, my view of that has changed. About psychiatry and psychology, at the point that I was, after those two losses, I thought, if anything helps even 5%, I'll do it. And of course, I thought psychology and psychiatry was a help, and it was. But what you find, actually, in many of these texts are exactly the same kinds of ways of trying to deal with emotional distress, just as Buddhism does that, by starting out by saying all life is suffering, and then tries to explore how to get to a point beyond suffering. Actually, my agent decided, he said to me, Elaine, why don't you write a book on suffering? And I said, John, I want to get through this. I don't want to become an expert and go on Oprah Winfrey and talk about suffering. Forget it. So these texts are ways of exploring deeper states of understanding and spiritual process. And the one you mentioned, if you bring forth what Jesus says in the Gospel of Thomas, if you bring forth what is within you, what you bring forth will save you. If you do not bring forth what is within you, what you do not bring forth will destroy you. Well, I took that on a psychological level, and that's why I wrote the Gnostic Gospels. I love that saying. These texts are as much about finding, they're not so much about who is Jesus, although they are, but they're also about who are you? Who am I? And one of the answers to that question in the Gospel of Thomas is that Jesus teaches in the Gospel of Thomas, which you won't find. The other Gospels say, believe in Jesus and be saved because he died for your sins. And he will save you. And the church that represents him is the only mode of salvation. These other Gospels say, okay, so you believed in Jesus. Now let's talk about what you know by experience, what you understand. And it teaches, here Jesus teaches that he manifests the divine light in the world, the divine energy from which everything comes. There's a wonderful saying in the Gospel of Thomas that I love, so I can't help telling you about it. Jesus said, I am the light that is before all things. I am all things. All things come forth from me. All things return to me. Split a piece of wood and I am there. Lift up a rock and you will find me. So this idea is that Jesus is the manifestation of a divine energy that brought everything into being, the stars, the trees, everyone here, all of us. And the next message of the Gospel of Thomas is, you too come from that light. So Jesus teaches his disciples, if people say to you, who are you? Don't say, well, Sally Quinn, Elaine Pagels, or whatever. But say, we, on another level, not the personal level, we come from the light, the place where the light came into being in the beginning of time. And if people say, well, who are you? Say, we are children of the light, children of the living Father. So the idea here is that on a spiritual level, We come from a divine source, and we are only whole when we know that. Now, psychiatry, and I'll finish. Psychiatry, I think, is very useful and very good in psychology because it deals with a lot of passions, emotions, and feelings that people ordinarily don't want to feel and we need to feel. We need to experience to know who we are. But often, as you know, psychiatry has said, well, religion is basically illusion. That's what Freud said. It's all fantasy. It's all meaningless, essentially. It's just, you know, we make up daddy in the sky because daddy isn't here, and we need that kind of protection. That's Freud's Future of an Illusion. And the book that we were talking about before we started, William James' Varieties of Religious Experience, was written by an American psychiatrist, William James, brother of Henry James, who himself fell into a terrible depression. And he came out of the depression by hanging on to religious slogans that he didn't believe in, like, the Lord is my helper, God is my helper. And somehow he got out of that depression. And he became aware that religion is not just some kind of fake fantasy illusion, but these are ways, ancient traditional ways that I think are rooted in the way our brains work, frankly, that can deeply help us out of, say, depression or grief or despair. I think psychiatry goes a long way, but I think we need more than that, because I found, at least for myself, I'll only speak for myself, that I think there's also a spiritual dimension in our life that goes beyond psychological and psychiatric insight for the most part, and that we need to get to that as well.
Well, the thing that's interesting is that that William James is a psychiatrist.
Yes.
That Viktor Frankl is a psychiatrist. They're both writing,
yes,
about the meaning of life and religion. I don't know whether we discussed Ernest Becker's book, The Denial
we
of
did.
Death. But all of them are touching on the idea that man is sort of a spiritual being, and that as much as you know yourself, there is something beyond. Now, Ernest Becker talks about Freud, who sort of made psychoanalysis competitive with religion. I mean, he saw psychoanalysis as his own religion, but Freud also had a little moment where he became very superstitious and borderline religious, and was very sort of upset and ashamed of this moment. It didn't quite know how to deal with it, and it sort of tormented him for mm-hmm. for years, because he began to think that maybe psychiatry was not everything and that you might need more, which I thought was really interesting. That was Ernest Becker. But I just want to get back to Jesus for a moment, because the Gnostics were not always sure that Jesus was really the Son of God. And I know that in those days, the Son of God didn't necessarily mean the Son of God. It could mean, you know, like King David,
right,
the kings were called Son of God too. So, but that they felt that he was the light, but not necessarily the mm-hmm. incarnation of God. And that the whole notion of the resurrection was something that people grasped onto, because for them it meant that if Jesus was resurrected, that meant that somehow they would not die either. And when Ernest Becker talks about in The Denial of Death, is essentially our whole lives are about repressing the idea that we're all going to die, which is just too unthinkable. And so we all try in various ways to find ways to find a way to deal in our lives with the fact that we are going to die, or to repress that, and that for some people the idea of Jesus is really helpful because it means that we aren't. How do you feel about Jesus and the resurrection and the idea that that may be a metaphor for our denial of death?
I love your enormous questions. So
I love your enormous answers.
there is a quite a difference between the way the New Testament Gospels talk about Jesus and the way these other Gospels talk about Jesus. It's not that they're necessarily in contradiction, but the people who wrote the secret Gospels claim that the Gospels of the New Testament give you what Jesus taught in public to thousands of people out on the hills of Galilee, but that the other Gospels are what Jesus taught in private to certain disciples, the way that any rabbi of the time would have taught differently to his disciples than he would in public. And what the New Testament Gospels all say is that Jesus is a hugely unique being. The Gospel of Mark is the earliest. It starts out with the saying, "This is the good news of Jesus, the Messiah, the Son of God." And the whole book is about Jesus. You must believe in Jesus. He is the way. The Gospel of John says, Jesus said he was the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to God except through Jesus. And so the focus on Jesus as the exclusive way to God is the linchpin of all of the Christian churches, whether Catholic and Protestant, and the people among them who are not all of them by any means, as you know, but some in both churches and Orthodox as well, say, you have to be in this communion or you're out. I remember Rick Warren saying that last year quite forcefully. Mm. The other Gospels speak of Jesus as a being who has realized the divine source from which we come. It's more, I won't say like a Buddha figure, but it is kind of like one who understands the deeper nature of reality. And it invites you not to become just a follower of Jesus, which you presumably already are, you wouldn't be reading these Gospels, but it invites you to recognize that you are part of what he is, and you recognize that you're like him. So it's not about Jesus alone. It's about discovering through the truth that he teaches something about you and me and our place in the universe and our relationship to God. I think psychiatrists are very much divided. I've actually had an interesting conversation this winter with the American Psychoanalytic Society. They asked me to talk about various things, which are really interesting. We have so many issues in common that interest us. Some of them basically say, well, you know, all of this religion stuff is just, you know, architecture in the mind that the culture constructs and builds there, and it's all a convenient way to hide from the deeper realities of life, which are, you know, the fact that we're all essentially extinct. I like Viktor Frankl because he allows for more mystery than that. I mean, if you know his book, he wrote it in Auschwitz as a prisoner, a psychiatrist in Auschwitz, watching who could survive and how. He wanted to survive, and he did. And he talked about one of the means of survival for people in an absolutely desperate situation was a sense of hope and a sense of meaning. And he talks even about a woman who's dying in Auschwitz and sees a tree outside the window. And she says it speaks to her. And he thought, oh, well, she's really gone over the deep end now. And he said, well, what does a tree say to you? And she said, the tree says, I am life, eternal life. So there's some way of talking about life beyond our lives that isn't necessarily naive and foolish and deluded, as some psychiatrists think.
Well, what Viktor Frankl had three ideas, he said, for having meaning in your life. One of them is work doing deeds.
Right.
Another one is experiencing something important. And the third one is your attitude towards suffering. And he talked about, even if, as a psychiatrist, even if you don't necessarily believe in God or are a religious person, that when you're treating a patient and that patient is religious, that it really helps you treat the patient because you can call on that patient's spiritual resources. And I was particularly interested also in William James, who he talks very respectfully about people's fantasies and their religious revelations and their what some of us would call mysticism, or people might even call spiritual trances, or New Age, whatever you might. He wrote his book in 1905. I mean, actually, it was a series of lectures that he gave at the University of Edinburgh. Mm-hmm. But the book is very anecdotal, and a lot of the anecdotes are people who say that, you know, they were walking down the street and they suddenly had this vision and were overtaken by it. And I wonder if you think that that's possible. I missed the Reverend Jakes yesterday, but apparently he was talking about, I missed the end of it, you put a key in the lock and sometimes there's a click and you hear a click. And that often people who, you know, people who are born again, or who people who find religion, or who people who find a meaning in life, that happens like that overnight. And I wonder what you feel about that. I mean, do you think that's possible? I mean, how do you get it? Well, what do you do to get that?
I know it's possible. I've seen it. Actually, one of the uses of William James' books, his writer's religious experience, is that it became the basis of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know this?
I did not know that.
Yeah. Well, what happened is that C.G. Jung, the psychoanalyst who knew about the book, gave it to a patient of his in about 1945 who was hopelessly alcoholic. And he said, the only thing that can cure somebody like you, whose compulsion is this, is alcohol, is some kind of religious experience. I've been trying to evoke that in you, but it hasn't worked. So read this book. And he read William James, and he created 12 steps toward a conversion experience, which actually seemed to work very well. I mean, I know from many people that is a possibility, that people do have experiences that reveal to them. I bet there are many people in this room who've had experiences momentary, and they may seem like just a fantasy sometimes, and I have, that reveal a reality and a joy and a transcendence in the universe that is something quite beyond anything we can articulate. Now, I was brought up to think religion was obsolete, you know, that as long as people got rational enough, scientific enough, technological enough, we wouldn't need religion anymore. And here we are in the 21st century. I don't think we're going to understand the 21st century unless we understand religion, because it's not a part of us that's going to go away. I'm convinced of this now. And so I think, well, what part of us is it? And I would suggest it's the part of us that we experience in our dreams. Not every dream, but all of us dream a lot, and we sleep a lot, and part of our mind is occupied in a completely different way than the waking reality. What the dream does is often put together things that don't seem connected rationally, or aren't connected rationally, or you can't connect them rationally, or I can't. But in the dream, you know there's a connection between this event and that event. The dream may be terrifying, or it may be beautiful. But I think as long as our brains, my late husband used to call it the lizard brain, I mean the very ancient part of our brain that doesn't think in words, but perceives in images and connections, that tries to put together phenomena, I think we're going to have religion. And religion seemed to me ways of structuring those deep unconscious reactions. For example, Christianity structures them, and so does Judaism, toward hope, right? You talk about the Exodus from Egypt. You're oppressed, you suffer, but God delivers the oppressed. That's the message of Daniel, or the message of Exodus, the message of the Passover. A message of hope about the future, even though the present is dark and has been for quite a while. And for Christians, it always struck me as kind of odd when over a coffin, people say the words, Jesus said, I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me will never die. And you think, either this is total double talk, you know, just denial of death, right? Mm-hmm. How much more denying can you get? Mm-hmm. Or it's some other way of speaking that goes quite beyond the literal reality.
William James has two chapters. One of them is on the well-being, and the other is on sickness or disease. He's talking about mental well-being and mental sickness. And in the well-being, he talks about people who are just happy all the time.
Yes.
And actually, we had a panel right before this with my husband, Ben Bradley, and Norman Lear, who were happy all the time.
That's great.
They're called the well-being.
Sorry. Sorry, Ben.
It annoys a lot of people, actually. And you know, this one man sort of describes, he was brought up in a nice Christian home, and he went to church, and they told him what to believe, and he believed it, and it worked, and he had a nice life, and everything was fine. And he lists a number of cases of people who have had who have this sense of well-being and sort of healthy-mindedness.
Yes.
What they call healthy, mm-hmm. and then goes into what he calls the sick mind. He's not making judgments. He's just basically saying these are two categories, and
right.
then talks about the sort of combined. The sick people are the ones who are depressed all the time, or who have these moments of depression. I mean, one man who said, you know, he was perfectly happy. He had a wonderful wife, wonderful children. He had a great job. He had everything in his life was perfect. And one day he woke up and he wanted to be dead. And he had
Tolstoy.
Well, Tolstoy is one of them. Yeah.
Leon Tolstoy describes this in his Confessions.
Right. And it took it was Tolstoy. It took him a long time to get back to, you know, to being a real person and having a real life. So in a way, it sort of sounds as though if you are a religious person and if you believe in God and or whatever that means, and you have that thing that sustains you, it means that you're healthy, and that if you're depressed all the time, it means, and you don't believe in God, it means you're not. And would you like to talk about that a little bit?
Sure. The religion of healthy-mindedness, as he describes it, isn't about believing in God. It's about a disposition of people who really are in love with the world, and what I know of Norman Lear, I don't know your husband well, but you know, is like that. It's a marvelous thing. My late husband was like that. Just took great delight in the world and wasn't particularly religious. It's a fortunate disposition. He thought that Walt Whitman was a paradigm of that.
Well, some people think that Walt Whitman is a little silly because he was so happy, happy, happy.
There are traces in his writings that aren't, but he certainly cultivated a sense of joy and appreciation in the universe. He says that is a disposition that he thinks of as a religious disposition, but it's often not expressed at all by anyone who has a God or a theology or anything. It doesn't need it. I mean, I saw this myself. The religion of the divided self, he says, are people who are in conflict. And often he says that deep internal conflict finds resolution by itself, and often finds resolution in a sense of a divine presence. He spoke of St. Augustine as a paradigm of that. And Leon Tolstoy, if you ever read his magnificent little book called The Confessions, he's the one who says, I had a magnificent life. I had, you know, I'd written wonderful novels. I knew everybody. I had a marvelous family. And I just, you know, I kept having to hide the gun so that I wouldn't shoot myself. And then he talks about a long process of somehow coming to terms with his deep sense of meaning in life and the desire to live. It wasn't overtly religious. He sort of went into the Russian church and then kind of went through it. But he came out to a place in which he said he felt balanced in the universe. So these are not about religions per se,
right.
I don't think.
What, do you think that if someone is not a religious person, and my whole view of what that means has changed in the last year, but if somebody is not a believer, if somebody does not believe in God the way the church says you, is there any way that you can benefit from religion or spirituality? Can you get something out of it? If you feel you don't believe that, if you feel, as I have, as I said, I've always called myself an atheist, but that you're looking for something that's more meaningful to you, where do you go? What can you do? Certainly if organized religion is not the answer, but that you feel the need for something, if you feel that all human beings have a need for a divine presence.
I don't know if all people do. I didn't think my late husband did. It was just part of his makeup, and I know a lot of physicists like that who don't think in those terms at all. But those who do, I mean, I know a lot of people who are artists, painters, they are musicians. I mean, I think creative work often fulfills for people, mine does a lot, that sense of meaning or other things. It could be about children and family. I remember after my late husband's death, I thought, well, we've adopted these two babies, and it's no honor to my late husband to just decide, you know, I can't do this. You know, I could do this. I have to take care of these children. And that's part of it. That was part of a sense of meaning. But I think there are many ways people find it. I went back to a church for a while, and that I found that helpful. And it's one way I find helpful. It's not the only way. Friendships, creative work, being out in this magnificent wilderness. I'm sure there's many ways as people in this room. But I did have a sense of connectedness with the universe and with other people is somehow essential for many of us. I don't think everybody's naturally religious. You know, there are theologians like Paul Tillich who said, well, if you don't think you're religious, it's just because you're ignoring it. Well, I don't think that's true at all. I think there are some people who don't need it in that way.
I one of the people that I've been talking to in the last year is Episcopalian priest who is retired, and he's been talking to me and teaching me a little bit, and I said, do you believe in the creed, you know? And he said, not a word, not one word, you know, the resurrection of Christ. And he said, no, in fact, I think it probably should be sung instead of said, because it's just, but he said, I see it much more as symbolic. And I said, well, do you believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God? And he said, no, I certainly do not. And I was so shocked, but he said, you know, there's so many people, and so many religious people, priests, and where the church has gone so wrong is that it really has become so political, and it's so institutional, that it doesn't actually fill the need of the people who go there. They go there for spiritual needs, and they're not getting what they need. And he said all of these things, like the creed and the Lord's Prayer and things, are things people can hang on to as symbolic, but and that give them comfort. But he said, I don't necessarily believe that, and I don't think as a religious person you have to believe that. We get back to what we were talking about in the very beginning.
Well, as I wrote in the beginning of Beyond Belief, I wandered into a Episcopal church on First Avenue. I was actually out jogging, and that was a place to get warm that day, and there was a service going on, and I was enormously moved by the singing. And I found that community, the Church of the Heavenly Rest, it's right by the Guggenheim in New York, to be a kind of spiritual home at a time when I really needed it. And I love, you know, the Episcopal service with the prayers, with the creed, I found it very deeply powerful. But the reason I called the book Beyond Belief is that I think belief itself didn't interest me much, and in a state of grief that I was, I didn't feel I believed in anything particularly. But there are ways beyond that, that this kind of communion and its teachings, the teachings about the love of God, the teachings about the love of human beings for each other, and the connectedness of the universe, struck me as enormously important, actually indispensable at that point.
One of the things that I did, I had never been in a synagogue except for two bar mitzvahs and two funerals, and So this year I went to the Rosh Hashanah services and then Yom Kippur, and I went to Kol Nidre, and then I did the whole thing the next day from 9 in the morning until 7:30 at night. And I didn't fast, but I didn't eat as much as I normally do.
It's called fasting.
And I've never been so moved and so overwhelmed by anything as I was that service. Mm. And I think it was the length of it and the repetition and the chanting and the cantor. And it wasn't the words that really meant that much to me, but it was the whole sense of community. It was in a conservative synagogue in Washington. But it was a very, I just found it very moving and very powerful. And so I sort of began to get some sense of that, and then ended up going to the National Cathedral and some other places in Washington where I began to see, because I had always been so hostile to the idea of religion, but more organized religion and what some of the evil that has been done by religion, that I hadn't really focused on the spiritual dimension of it, which suddenly became much clearer to me after having been through these services.
Well, I can appreciate organized religion in the sense that it helped these traditions survive, but my experience is very much like yours, that something happens in those, in these very ancient liturgies that is, you can't explain, that speaks to something much deeper than your reason or mine. It's not about do you believe it, but my sense of it is it's sort of like when you go to an incredible concert and you say, you don't have to believe Beethoven, but can you participate? Does it take you in? Are you in that music, and are you engaged and powerfully transformed by it? And that's what these liturgies are for. That's why I wrote Beyond Belief. I don't think belief in itself was enough for where I was at that time. It had to be something like what you describe, where something else happens, and it speaks to you on a different level.
I wonder if anyone has any questions. Yeah. I feel like I've been hogging Elaine the whole time. Let's... I have so many things to ask her myself. Yeah.
Right.
Listening to both of you, I think it would might help all of us if you seem to collapse religion and spirituality. They can exist independently, they can exist together. And what have we been talking about? The relevance of spirituality and how that has helped you, or the relevance of religion, and if it's the latter, do we only mean traditional, institutional, William James, or the varieties of religion? Did William James mean religious or spirituality? Can you help us with those words?
That's a very hard question. You know, and one thing, when you said that, I was thinking what we haven't talked about are the rise of, say, fundamentalist religions in the world. And, you know, to underestimate the power of that is something that we can't afford anymore.
I know there had been several panels about that earlier, I didn't want to get you to have to repeat all of that again.
That's true, although I think it's something that we need to recognize meets the needs of innumerable people in ways that we need to be quite aware of, and I think we are here. I don't know, William James, Tolstoy, and other religious seekers start with religion, I mean, whatever that is, religious structures, and really try to go far beyond it.
When you say you're a seeker, what are you seeking? Spirituality or religious experience, or is it sinning?
Well, yeah, that's a good question. Religious experience is a transient thing. I think a sense of spirituality is a deeper thing, and I guess that's what I seek and sometimes find in these works.
Oh, I think you had a hand.
With all your research, who is Jesus to you? And what about the Da Vinci Code?
Can you repeat the question?
The question is, who is Jesus to me, and what about the Da Vinci Code? two big ones. I find Jesus fascinating because, I mean, I'm a historian, basically. And how this figure, Jesus of Nazareth, with this terribly unlikely story, I mean, he's crucified, he's abandoned, he dies, how that story has become the focus of the lives of billions of people all over the world fascinates me. And I think it's a very interesting story. For myself, it's more that kind of exploration of Jesus and who he is historically. The Da Vinci Code was written on the basis of the kind of research that people have been doing on these so-called Gnostic Gospels. He acknowledges it. He wrote it in his book that he'd read the Gnostic Gospels that I wrote. He read other books. And I think it's fine as fiction and fantasy. It was hard for me to read because he mixes up what really happened from what, from his sort of conspiratorial thriller. And I find what really happened much more interesting myself. But that's just my own, that's what I do.
I noticed there's some people who are clearing out, but why don't we take two more questions?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, and then I'll get you next.
Can constitute a form of escapism from reality. Difficult for a person with an analytical mind to deal with the problems of it somehow, bringing his attention and distract from by music and religious experience. Now, I recognize that we all escape. When I go to the university basketball football game, there's no intellect involved at all. But it doesn't presuppose the existence of a deity.
You pray at the half.
Oh, you let me down.
Right.
But I think the real problem is a person with an analytical mind who tends to approach problems of life with the intellect rather than the visceral.
Well, I agree with you that there are a lot of uses of religion which are basically forms of avoidance of reality. They're basically forms of escapism. They're forms of denial. You know, I mean, you might as well just turn on the television and believe that, you know. I think that there are pathological and uses of religion that way. And many people do that. I also think, though, that beyond the rational mind, there are other ways of imagining and realizing aspects of the universe that don't fit into the rational mind.
I think in the yellow shirt, and then I think that's it. They're going to throw us out.
Yep, they're going to throw us out.
So just briefly, I recall in the Gnostic Gospels, you said that there was a conference in the church in about 480 that they determined heretical.
Yes.
I was thrown out. And of course, since you published your book and brought them back to public visibility, what have there been reactions with your back to the church to it? Do people consider it radical now?
It's a good question. You know, there are as many views on that as people. What I realized, especially in the last book, Beyond Belief, was that what made these gospels highly objectionable to the bishops was the suggestion, which is what the monks were attracted to, the idea that you can have your relationship with God directly. And that because it suggested you could relate to God directly, because you're created in the image of God and you're connected with God, that was something that many bishops did not want to have acknowledged, because it meant that it would make the church institution less important. Then you couldn't say outside the church there's no salvation, because you could get there by yourself. So I think there are many political... I mean, my book was taken to be about political and social structures of the church and how they excluded elements that didn't help the process of institutional formation. But I do think we need them. That's why if you go to Snowmass and you talk to the Trappist monks who live up in those mountains and worship God, they are inviting the Buddhists to come teach them about spiritual process. Because what was Christian spiritual formation in the early centuries was thrown out and called heresy. So we don't have the techniques that Buddhist teachers do, or even that Kabbalistic Judaism has taught in mystical Judaism. I think many of what was eliminated with these Gnostic Gospels were mystical forms of Christianity that the church found a little dangerous for just normal people to read, because it might suggest that you don't have to go through the church.
I think that's all. I'm Ken. Yeah. I think we're going to have to go. Thank you.
Well, that was fun.
That was fun. You were fun.